Thank you, Dr. Trask. And Andrea and Eric, good luck to you. You're in the process right now, right? So we wish you the best of luck. I have my form filled out for you guys, so be sure to come by. If anybody has a form filled out, raise your hand. Raise your hand, both hands or one hand? Raise your hands high if you have a form filled out. We can pick them up throughout the day also. Does anyone have a question for Dr. Trask or for Andrea or Eric? Because I always have questions if you don't. As I precept and have pre-med students, one of the most difficult things for me is writing the letter of recommendation. Do you have helps for us regarding that?
Sure. Typically, first of all, we want the letter of recommendation to be a page long, no longer. Typically, it will start out with a paragraph that describes how you, in what capacity you know the person for whom you're writing the letter. So as a professor, I'll start out saying, I had a student in a class, the class was this size, so if it's a giant class, they know that, you know, I'm having one student out of 100. If that student stands out in one in 100, then that's a good thing, right? For you all, you would say, I had a student who shadowed me for this many hours over this much period of time, and you let the committee know, I guess, how well you know the applicant. And then American Association of Medical Colleges has published a document called the Guide to Letter Writers, and I'm asking that my students include that guide when they request the letter, but typically that guide will talk about specific character traits that they're interested in learning about, so reliability, dependability, curiosity, those sorts of things. So addressing those character traits in the rest of the letter that you've observed. They don't want you to address all of them, but just the character traits that you've observed. And then concluding with whether or not you feel like that student would be a good candidate for acceptance. So that's, and it's okay to say no if you think that the student isn't good. We want you to be honest because we feel like that's our reputation on the line as well. So honesty is the best policy.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dr. Trask. Well, I'd like to ask for one more round of applause for Dr. Trask, Andrea, Eric, and the College of Science that provided our breakfast this morning. Thank you very much. Well, once again, welcome to our meetings, our annual meetings with the theme of the joy of medicine. This morning, I've been associated with the Society for 23 years since I came to Ogden as a resident, and my favorite part of the meetings has always been the what's new in my specialty, because I always feel that I get something from that I can put into practice or that I can feel more complete as a physician. So I always look forward to these morning sessions. We're going to start this morning with Dr. Brad Stevenson, urology, and his topic is minimally invasive treatment for the enlarged prostate. Dr. Stevenson.
Good morning. It's nice to be here. I'd like to thank the Society for inviting me to speak this morning. So let's see here. So we're going to talk about a new minimally invasive procedure in urology for the prostate. So let's just begin by reviewing the prostate, its anatomy, and its function. So the prostate is a gland that sits at the base of the bladder. You can see it here in the sagittal view. It basically surrounds the urethra at that point, or you can think of it as actually is the urethra. We call it the prostatic urethra. And its function is in, it's a reproductive function. It produces fluid, seminal fluid, to support reproduction. Now, once you've passed your reproductive years, the prostate serves nothing but to be a pain in the prostate. So there are several issues that are common with the prostate. Infection can happen at any age, but the cancer and BPH, or enlargement of the prostate, are typically things that come with an aging population. So prostate cancer is estimated that 1 in 7 men will get a cancer in their prostate. And BPH, basically, if you live long enough, you're likely going to get BPH sooner or later. So today I'm going to focus on enlargement of the prostate. So basically BPH, which is a benign enlargement of the prostate, causes obstruction of the urine flow because the urethra goes through the prostate. I tell patients that it's like a donut and you pee through the donut hole. And then as it enlarges, it's like those little powdered donuts you see in the packages. It gets a very small donut hole. And that leads to a number, and here's some actual pictures of it, cystoscopic images. So this is what we call lateral lobe enlargement, where the sides of the prostate push down and compress the channel. This here is a median lobe, so you see it's pushing up into the channel. Ideally, in these two pictures, you'd be able to see straight into the bladder. And this is a retroflexion of the scope, so it's in the bladder and looking back at itself at the bladder exit right there. And this right here is a big median lobe, which we call a ball valve median lobe. So basically that prostate, when you try to pee, that median lobe is blocking off the exit of the prostate. So this all leads to symptoms that are bothersome. So we can divide these urinary symptoms into what are called obstructive symptoms and irritative symptoms. So the obstructive symptoms just come from the fact, the mechanics of flowing, trying to flow fluid through there. So you get a slow stream, hesitancy, which is where you have to stand and kind of wait for the stream to start. You get starting and stopping, incomplete emptying. But what happens over time is as that prostate enlarges, the bladder, which is a muscle, has to push harder to get the urine out. And just like any other muscle, if you work it out, it gets thicker and stronger. And in the case of the bladder, that's not a good thing because then you end up with what are called these irritative symptoms. So that's a urinary frequency and urgency, nocturia, which is getting up all night. And then you can't even get incontinence. And this is typically what's called urgency incontinence, or you can even get overflow incontinence. And that's because the bladder, when those muscle bundles have gotten hypertrophied, it doesn't stretch as much, and when it squeezes too hard. So all in all, it's a common symptoms that we see, and it's not pleasant. When it gets severe, it can kind of take over your life. You always have to know where a bathroom is. So there are several treatments for enlarged prostate. So usually our first line is medical therapy. And so this is basically broken down into two classes of medication. There are alpha blockers. So this is Flomax and Rapaflow or some of the newer ones. All the alfuzosin, terazosin, all those zosin medications are kind of older ones that can also be used for blood pressure. But basically that relaxes the tone in the prostate. So it doesn't do anything to change the size of the prostate. It just relaxes. It opens up the channel. And then there are the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, which actually block the hormonal signal for growth in the prostate. And so those will, over time, shrink the prostate. So that's finasteride, dutasteride. Now, both of these medications can have side effects. The alpha blockers sometimes cause, because of the vasodilation, some lightheadedness. In about 10% of men, they cause what's called a retrograde ejaculation or anejaculation. And then the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors usually have, or their most common side effects are sexual side effects as well, so decreased libido, erectile dysfunction. So although it's easy to kind of take the pills as opposed to a procedure, there are side effects, as with any medication. So the standby, kind of gold standard surgical procedure that's been around for decades is the TURP, or transurethral resection of the prostate. And so this is a surgical procedure where you actually, physically remove tissue from the prostate. This is done transurethrally, as the name implies, and the technology has improved to make the recovery better and easier. But basically, the whole idea is that you're trying to remove this obstructing tissue so you have a nice big channel in here. Now there is a recovery involved with that. You can kind of see this patient here. He's got his fluid hanging, running through his catheter and draining out bloody urine right there. And so that's typically a night or two in the hospital. And then you're disrupting the lining of the prostate. So it takes, you know, a month, 6 weeks or so to kind of reestablish that lining. So as with any surgical procedure, there's a recovery involved with that. And patients have everyone's heard a horror story about TURP. I don't know why people do this. The same with like vasectomies or whatever. Like if you've had a friend that has it, they tell you the worst possible things they can tell you. And so patients come in and they're very hesitant to get a TURP because they've heard bad things about it. So there's always been, just with as with any procedures, surgical procedures, a push to find more or less invasive procedures, ones that are easier to recover from. So there have been some in the past. So there's what's called a microwave therapy, which is using microwaves to kind of heat the prostate tissue and try to kill it off. There's a what's called TUNA, which is also a transurethral therapy using radio frequency to, again, heat the cells and kill them off. And these have kind of fallen out of favor. It's very difficult to find anybody who does them or residencies that will train you on them because they have been found to not be long-lasting and usually no better than taking a medication with more side effects than the medication. So I'm going to talk to you today about a new in-office minimally invasive procedure that looks very promising, and it's called a Rezūm. It's actually a water vapor therapy. So this works a little bit differently than the prior minimally invasive procedures. So the concept behind this is that when you transition from a liquid to a gas, there's a lot of, and then back from that transition, there's a lot of energy stored right in that transition point. That's what this is showing here, that once you hit that boiling point, there's a lot of energy stored in that steam. And then when you go back from steam to water, you release all that energy. And so the idea is that as the steam interacts with the prostate cells, it intersperses through the cells and kind of kills those cells off. And then your body, through its own natural mechanisms, will kind of clear out that debris. Now, how is this different from the prior minimally invasive therapies? And it's basically the difference between convection and conduction, right? So the steam, as I just mentioned, will actually kind of intersperse between all the cells and cause what we call kind of a consistent kill zone. Whereas conductive therapy, a heat source is placed in the urethra at the prostate, and you rely on that heat source conducting through the tissues. And so you have to produce a lot of heat to try to spread to these cells. And so these cells get a lot of heat. These cells get probably the ideal amount for killing the cells. And then the ones deeper in get damaged but not killed. And so I think there's a... Yeah, so if we look here, this is the difference. So that's the convection over here, which is very quick as well. I mean, that's the idea behind like a convection oven, right? You circulate the temperature. And this showing here, the older procedures, that heat source had to be left in the prostate for a long time. And what you end up with here is really kind of fried cells here, kind of ideally killed cells here, and the damaged cells at the side. And so that's what led to kind of bothersome side effects and be not great results from that procedure. And so just theoretically, the way this works, this is a much better way to do that. So if you look at the comparisons of improvement with these separate kinds of procedures, let me go back here. So here's the Rezūm over here. So this is a reduction in, or yeah, so these are kind of symptoms afterwards. Oh no, sorry, excuse me. These are repeat procedures. So with the Rezūm compared to the other minimally invasive procedure, you see that many of these had up to a, you know, close to a 30% retreat rate. UroLift is another new minimally invasive procedure that I won't be talking about today, but it doesn't remove tissue. It's basically staples that pinch the prostate open. But again, because the resumes actually removing tissue, has the lowest retreat rate of these other minimally invasive procedures. Now, this kind of illustrates the reason why there's less kind of irritation and damage compared to those other therapies, is that because we're using convection in the water vapor, you use a lot less energy. You look here, the radio frequency and the microwave both have to produce a lot of heat to cause their damage, because you're relying on that heat to push through the tissues. That's just, again, the difference between convection and conduction. So let me talk about how this procedure is done. So the prostate is broken into different zones. You see the green there is the transition zone. That's typically where BPH happens. And then the central zone, which is kind of that pinkish-orangish area, that's the median lobe when you saw that ball valve. You can also get BPH happening in the central zone. Now, the peripheral zone, which is around the outside of the prostate, is where typically prostate cancer develops. So our goal is to treat, in BPH, is to treat the transition zone and the central zone. So what Resume does in the office is a transurethral procedure, and a scope is placed into the prostate, and the areas that are needing to be treated, there's a small needle that will be stuck into the prostate, and then it'll deliver steam to that area. So here's a video of the actual procedure. So this is the cystoscopy. You see this little device there. What he's doing right now is measuring the prostate, and then he's turning up to one of those lateral lobes, and he'll come back a centimeter. So one field of view is a half a centimeter, so he comes back 1 centimeter. Make sure that he's in a good spot, and then you'll see this little trocar poke into the prostate. And then it delivers the steam, which is happening right now. You can kind of see that tissue swelling back there. And each delivery is 9 seconds. It's timed by the device. And so it's very quick to deliver that. An average prostate takes 4 or 5 injections. I mean, so this is a 5-minute procedure in the office compared to a TURP, which typically lasts an hour in the operating room. So then we won't watch the whole thing, but he goes through and hits that tissue several times. I'll just show you one thing here. You can kind of see that tissue blanching out, and that's the steam or the heat having its effect on the prostate tissue. So you see on the right there how white it is compared to the other side. So they've actually done these MRI studies when they were developing this this technology, and you can identify the transition zone or that BPH zone on MRI. So this is following that over time, and you see here the preoperative, and then as time goes on, those transition zones and the effect they have, and so they get smaller and smaller. What this is actually showing is the damaged zones from the steam right at. So this isn't preoperative. This is immediately postoperative. So what you see is that you get over 3 to 6 months about a 30 to 40% decrease in the transition zone, which makes up the majority volume of the prostate. So you're decreasing your prostate size by about a third on average. So here's kind of a picture of a pre-treatment with the big median lobe. You see that bulging up into the bladder neck. And then 6 months later, all that has been destroyed, and you have a nice open bladder neck. So the two things we want to know with any procedure are, is it safe and is it effective, right? So here are the potential adverse events. Resume is actually a really pretty safe procedure. Now, it's common, and these numbers are, at least from our experience, this is probably a little bit on the low side, because most patients will have a period of dysuria or burning when you pee, and some hematuria just postoperatively, and that's because there's inflammation in the prostate, et cetera, urinary frequency. So these are very common after the procedure, but typically resolve over 2 to 3 weeks. As far as any long-term side effects, there haven't been any reports of strictures or injury to, you know, rectal injury or anything like that. No reports of incontinence, et cetera. As far as the urinary symptoms, how good is it at controlling urinary symptoms? The IPSS is the International Prostate Symptom Score. That's a standardized questionnaire that's used to measure prostate symptoms. The higher you are, the worse it is. And so this is the studies again that they used for FDA approval for this procedure. A baseline. These are moderate. 22 is about as moderate to severe urinary symptoms. And you see over the course of 3 years that drops down to kind of mild. So you're seeing a 50% reduction typically in urinary symptoms. And if you compare that to medication and more invasive surgery, here's Rezūme over here. This 14-point reduction is for men who had more severe symptoms. So the more severe you are, the more improvement you see. But you see that's comparable to TURP or the laser, which is similar to the TURP, but instead of cutting the tissue, a laser is used to vaporize the tissue. So basically the same idea, just different energy sources to remove the tissue. And then alpha blockers, which are the Flomax, have a moderate decrease in urinary symptoms. So comparable to surgical procedures with less side effects and much better than a single oral therapy. So one thing that the men often worry about with any prostate treatment is sexual function. And so we talked about how the alpha blockers cause in 1 in 10 men ejaculatory issues. The 5-alpha reductase inhibitors cause erectile dysfunction, et cetera. So they looked at this as well in their studies. Oh, and also to mention the TURP or the laser, you're 100% guaranteed retrograde ejaculation with those procedures, basically. And so that's a concern for many men. And so this was looked at with the Rezūme as well. And what you can see here is most men in the study had some mild sexual dysfunction. This again is a standard. This number comes from a standardized symptom score for erectile dysfunction and stuff. So you can see that over the 3 years, there's basically little change in their sexual function, and that includes preserving antegrade ejaculatory function, which is unique even to unique to BPH treatments, even the medical treatment. So that's been a positive as well. So this is an interesting. Who's a candidate for the Rezūme? So this is an interesting slide. They studied four large urology group practices across the country, and they looked at all the men that were referred into those urology practices for BPH. About 20% of them had never had any sort of treatment for BPH. Two-thirds of them had been on medical management, Flomax or one of the other medications. And then a kind of a spattering had some sort of treatment, but were still having symptoms. So you see here that there are a lot of men who have failed some sort of treatment. I mean, you're looking at 80% of men who have been 80% of men who are coming into a urologist have failed some sort of treatment for BPH. So really the Rezūme, the nice thing about it is that because it's low risk and it's not a very difficult recovery, we can offer this to a wide variety of men. Typically a TURP we wouldn't have done unless a patient had been on medical therapy for a very long time and they had bothersome symptoms, and they're like, okay, it's finally time to go under surgery. But for Resume, you know, we see men who have failed medical therapy, so the medications just aren't working that well, or they're doing okay on medical therapy, but not as good as they want to. The other thing is that we have men who don't want to take medication, or you know, the medication's too expensive, or they have side effects from the medication, or they just, maybe the medication works well, but they don't like the idea of being on chronic medication. So basically, this can be offered as a first-line therapy for men who are interested in that. So kind of in summary here, BPH is extremely common. It's often undertreated or goes untreated. A lot of men wait till it's too late just because they just don't want to come in and talk about it. The Resume is a newer in-office treatment. You saw those studies are out 3 years. It's been around for 3 years, and it's quick and easy in the office. It has, like I say, a 2 to 3 week period. I tell patients, you're gonna not like me for 2 to 3 weeks because those symptoms are gonna be bothersome. But after that, the results are comparable to surgical treatment with low long-term side effects. So that's it. I'll take any questions if you have any. Yeah. So he asked, what about embolization of the prostate? So that has not kind of caught on yet. It's still kind of in the they're looking at it, but so far, and they've tried that several times, some version of that in the past, and as of now, it hasn't really panned out. So
for patients who have had previous procedures done outside of TURP, like microwave therapy or tunas, can this procedure still be applied to those individuals?
Yes. So he asked if they've had some other procedure, even men who have had a TURP, we've done that on them. So even if you've had a TURP and cleared out the prostate, it can grow back over time. So basically, if you can go in and you can see obstructing tissue, you can do this procedure.
Question?
Yeah, where is that?
Right here.
Oh, thank
you. So, you know, being in primary care, we have a gentleman that has an elevated PSA, and he has a palpatory enlarged prostate. Do you have to do any biopsies to rule out malignancy before you proceed with something like this?
Yeah, so we'll typically screen them for prostate cancer, and if it's suspicious, then we would do a biopsy beforehand. You know, things like TURP, we would, in the past, you'd want to make 100% sure that they didn't have cancer before you do a TURP, because prostate cancer treatment after a TURP is very difficult, because this changes the size but not the anatomy of the prostate. You can actually still do prostate cancer treatment after a Resume without much difficulty from it. But we always do. We want to make sure that they don't have a cancer before we proceed.
And also, because it looks like it's just more or less scalding or burning, what's the pain compared to a TURP and some of your other procedures?
Sorry, what was that?
What is the pain level of the patients after this procedure? Because it's like a burn.
Yeah. So it's typically not pain. It's more patients describe kind of a pressure in the prostate. Some people say they feel like they're sitting on a tennis ball, and it's more the irritative urinary symptoms. So the frequency and urgency, kind of the symptoms that you'd see with a prostatitis. All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Dr. Stevenson. Our next What's New in my specialty is Dr. Steve Semper, homegrown and local. It's good to have him back. He's with Rocky Mountain Association of Physicians and going to give us the skinny on bariatric surgery.
Thanks. So it's a real pleasure to be here with you. I've always loved this meeting. It's a very good meeting. When I was at the Ogden Clinic years ago, I've had the pleasure of being on the program committee for a couple of years, and it was so much fun looking for speakers that were not only entertaining but educational, and that makes it a special honor to be here. So I don't know who came up with the skinny of bariatric surgery. They're much more creative than I am. So I thought the topic was what's new in bariatric surgery. That gives me a lot of leeway to kind of talk about different things, and hopefully you can get something out of it. Just a disclaimer, I am a faculty member on the Speakers Bureau for Ethicon Endosurgical, but we're not going to talk about any products, or so there should be no conflict of interest. We all know what the problem is, huge problem. 35% of the population in the United States is considered obese. 12% extremely obese is described as having a BMI of over 40. Interestingly enough, this has not changed significantly since 2003. So it's stabilized in that regard, but the unfortunate thing is the percent of the population that is extremely obese continues to grow. So while the population as a whole is not changing, heavy patients are getting heavier and heavier. Now, more recent data, and we're still waiting for the most recent data from the CDC, we're hoping that this stabilizes as well. Hugely expensive. Just a very conservative estimate is $200 billion in healthcare expenditures. It may be double or even triple this when you really look at the numbers. Over 200 or close to 200,000 deaths attributed, and then this may also be an underestimation. Interestingly, despite the severity of this problem, only about 1% of eligible patients seek bariatric surgery. So what are we doing with the other 99% of patients that fall in this category? Well, this is from the Swedish obesity study. Anybody who works in the field, either medical or surgical, with obesity is aware of this study. This is the largest, longest, ongoing prospective study in the world. And I want you to pay attention to that upper line there. That's their medical control arm. Now, the Swedes feel that they're successful in medical therapy when they can simply stabilize patients' weight and not have it continue to go up. And in reality, that is a success because this is an insidious progressive disease. So is it hopeless? No, actually, we've made some significant progress in medical therapy, and I'm not an expert in this, but this is a list of drugs that have been approved. For those of you who were around during the Fen-Phen era, Fen-Phen did work. Didn't work in everybody, but there were subgroups of people that it worked in, and it worked quite well. The problem was there were side effects, and people developed resistance. One drug in particular I'm interested in is that second drug there, the liraglutide, because it's a glucagon-like polypeptide 1 analog. Now, for those of you who treat diabetes, you recognize that many of our new diabetic agents are GLP-1 analogs. And what you probably don't know is that gastric bypass, one of the mechanisms of gastric bypass, is that it dramatically increases the patient's normal production of GLP-1, which is one of the mechanisms of how that surgery works. So we're now getting more physiological. We're getting more, instead of simply kind of poisoning the system, and we are making headway. There's over 30 other drugs. I didn't list them because they're not FDA approved, and I'm not an expert in them, but there is progress being made in the medical therapy. Problems, of course, cost. Just like surgery, it costs, and these drugs are expensive. Insurances often don't cover them. There are significant side effects with these drugs, and I think about the binding agents that occur. These patients suffer from problems with diarrhea, foul-smelling gas, and often fat-soluble vitamin deficiencies. Often in excess of those that we see in our surgical patients, for instance, the duodenal switch, which has some degree of malabsorption. So they're not perfect, but we are making headway. One of the biggest problems with medical therapy is we don't continue it lifelong. We get a patient on medications, we get them in a therapy, they lose 30 or 40 pounds, feeling better, their diabetes, hypertension is improved, and then we stop it because of side effects or costs or whatever. Obesity is a lifetime disease, and it must be treated lifelong. So just like high blood pressure and diabetes, these treatments need to be continued lifelong. So, and the problem, too, is just like diabetes and hypertension, is not everybody responds the same to the medications. And so you have to search and have a pattern to find a combination or a drug or a combination of drugs that works for that individual. And then they tend to develop resistance, so then you have to do a search again to find that, okay? It's complicated. Most of us do not do. I don't do medical weight loss therapy because it's too complicated. I'm a surgeon, remember. I'm I'm the non-cognitive side of the rub. So it's very complicated, and I think we need to explore this a lot more, and we need a lot more education because it is complicated. It's not just simply putting people on a diet and exercise. That has not been very effective. The biggest obstacle I see to treating this is our own attitudes. Okay. A study published in Journal of American Medical Association last summer showed that 80% of the public, including doctors, nurses, dietitians, healthcare workers, do not understand the disease of obesity and, quite frankly, aren't interested in understanding the disease of obesity. We already have made up our mind. This is a quote from Barry Sears. He's a biochemist, but he's wrote the book The Zone, and he studies biochemistry and anthropology to try to understand how biochemistry affects us all and so forth. And he states there are three things humans hold visceral, meaning to come from deep internal belief systems. And those are religion, politics, and nutrition. And obesity falls under that nutritional category. Now, religion's not supposed to be based on fact. It's supposed to be based on faith, right? Politics, we have no idea what it's based on, but it certainly isn't fact, whether you're on the right or the left, right? But nutrition, there are a lot of facts with nutrition, and yet we berry pick those facts and spin those facts to fit our own internal belief systems. You can't solve a problem unless you understand a problem, and obesity is one that we almost refuse to understand. So I'll just throw this out. I won't do much discussion. We're all guilty of this, that evidence-based medicine is only pertinent if the evidence supports our own point of view. We've got to get kind of past that. So anytime I'm trying to solve a problem, I like to look at smarter people than I to give me inspiration. Winston Churchill is one of my favorite characters in history. And he said that the further you look back, the clearer you look forward. Now, he was talking about world history, but it's very pertinent in medicine. Many of the latest, greatest, neatest things that we're talking about today have actually been done in the past, and if we look back, we can learn a lot more and not have to reinvent the wheel over again. Now, that leads me into new technologies with a question mark. And I'm going to give you my opinion. I hope I don't offend anybody. But again, I look at the gastric balloon. That's been released and approved by the FDA. There's at least two and I believe three gastric balloons now on the market. This has been around a long time. When I was a thoracic surgery fellow at the down at Biloxi VA, there were two general surgeons who had done research on gastric balloons 10 or 15 years before I got down there. Been around a long time, hasn't really worked, a lot of side effects. Patients are uncomfortable with the balloon. Does it help them lose weight? Sometimes. Can it last? Can you leave it in forever? No. It's a temporary treatment. The Aspire Assist, again, they put some ribbons and balloons and some perfume on it and call it some weird thing, but it's a gastrostomy tube. I find it hard to believe that people believe that it's okay to go and eat whatever they want then and sneak off the bathroom, suck it out, and flush it down the toilet. That's called surgically induced bulimia. But again, it's becoming more popular, and it's approved by the FDA. The EndoStitch technology, cool technology, okay? If you're a surgeon or a gastroenterologist that does a surgeon does endoscopy, these are technologies. There's about three of them on the market. You can look down the stomach with an EndoStitch, and you can stitch the stomach. You can plicate the stomach, and you can do some procedures through the scope that we used to do open. These are old procedures, though, and those procedures did not work. That's why we're not doing them today. So doing an old procedure in a new way, there's good physiologic reasons why those old procedures didn't work. So while if the technology's cool, doing old procedures in a new way doesn't mean it's going to work. So my answer is be cautious, be careful. Unfortunately, when you have such a desperate group, when you have 99% of your patients you really don't have good treatments for, we tend to fall into this category. And where we're seeing what we want to see than what is real, okay? The emperor's new clothes. And that happens in medicine, but it really happens, it's pervasive in the field of bariatric surgery due to the desperation of the patients, the ability for us to raise money and make a living off of some of these things. So we have to be careful. We have to be truly honest with ourselves. And that leads me into, well, actually, I came across this. I was at an MISS meeting in Las Vegas, and one of the speakers used this, three things that always tell the truth. I looked on the internet to see where this quote came from and couldn't find it. If this is a quote from any of you, let me know so I can give you credit for it. But there are three things that always tell the truth. What are those? Children, drunks, and yoga pants, okay? Now, I don't know about children and drunks, but yoga pants certainly tell the truth. So now I would contend that there is a fourth thing that always tells the truth. Dr. Ted Adams is going to get mad at me for showing his picture here, but he's a PhD researcher. He's lead author and organizer of the Utah Bariatric Study Group, and he wanted me to show his whole team and give them credit, but I didn't have a picture of the whole team, so I put his picture up. These are individuals. One of the, I think, the advancements and the new things in medicine in general, but particularly in bariatric surgery, is outcome data, true, honest outcomes data. And he's led the Utah Bariatric Study Group, which, by the way, is the second largest, longest ongoing study in the world with a prospective control group study. So I thought that we would go over that data. This is now published in New England Journal of Medicine in September of this past year, but if you missed that, we'll go over some of the data and some of the importance of that study. So the Utah Bariatric Study Group, I talked about, just some disclosures on that. This was research that was funded by the NIH. We actually ran out of funds at the very tail end, and Ethicon Endosurgical was generous to give us some funds to complete this project. We did not study products. We did not promote products. There should be no conflict of interest. So if you'll put my next slide set in, I appreciate it. So our study hypothesis was, is does Roux-en-Y gastric bypass surgery result in improved morbidity when severely obese non-surgical patients are compared to the surgical patients? Now, we did not look at lap band. We were not doing that. This study started in 2001. We weren't doing it at that time. We weren't doing sleeve gastrectomies or duodenal switch at that time. So again, this was a pure gastric bypass study. And again, that's kind of nice because it helps. When you have too many procedures, it muddies the water. So I apologize for this slide. It's not as clear, but our recruitment scheme at Rocky Mountain Associated Physicians, our patients are required to attend a risk and benefits class, which is a strictly informational class that we teach every Tuesday and every other Saturday for people who are interested in investigating weight loss surgery. At that time, these patients were then introduced to the possibility of participating in this study. They chose to do so and met criteria. They were enrolled in the study. Then they were admitted to the University of Utah Research Center, where extensive testing, sleep apnea, cardiac echoes, cardiac EKGs, a variety of other testing was done. And then they self-randomized to or self-selected to one of two groups. If they went on to have surgery, either they had insurance or had money to pay for it, they became the surgical group. The non-surgical group, number one, were patients who wanted to have surgery but did not have the financial resources, either insurance or otherwise, to have surgery, and they became non-surgical group number one. Now, the National Institute of Health asked us to do a second control group because they said these maybe the people seeking surgery are not the same as the big group of people who are not seeking surgery. So we have the advantage here in Utah to have the Utah Health Family Tree Program. If you're not aware of that, Utah's a very conscientious community, as most of you know. There are 150,000 families in Utah who have agreed to release their medical data for research, and their data is used by a variety of researchers, not just us. And we randomly selected severely obese patients from that to be our non-surgical group number two. Our recruitment hypothesis was that the group number one represented characteristics very similar or identical to the surgical group, and that the non-surgical group number two represented more the general population of the obese patients, which may be different. We didn't know. We don't know the characteristics, so maybe there might be some difference. So we enrolled 418 people in the surgical group, 417 people in the surgical group number one, and 321 group people in the group number two. So our follow-up, again, Utah's a great place to do these kind of studies. People move here and they don't move away. They're conscientious, they participate, and I will also tip my hat to Dr. Adams and his group who are very diligent at keeping track of these people. So we had somewhere between 96 to 99% of these patients who at 12 years we still were able to collect at least some data on. We had over 90% of patients who we were able to collect substantial data on at 12 years. Now, in a non-socialized healthcare system, that's just about unheard of. It's in the United States. People doubt us, but I can tell you this is really true. Our mortality data, this caused kind of a stir when we presented this data, even though there was no mortality difference between our surgical and non-surgical groups. Now, this was in conflict with an earlier study that we did where it was a retrospective study where we took almost 9,000 of our gastric bypass patients and compared them to an equally matched group of Utahns based on driver's license data that found that the surgical group, the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass group, had a 40% reduction in mortality over the study period, and the surgical patients were anywhere from 3 to 14 years out with a mean of 7 years, so that's a short period of time. But this did not show any statistical significance. But when people saw the suicide and poisoning was defined as most of these were patients who had drug overdoses, died of drug overdoses of unknown intent. And while it was not statistically significant, when you combine both suicide and poisoning, it started to approach statistically significant. And in the surgical group one, all those patients, those four patients that passed away, had crossed over and had surgery. So people said, well, what is it about gastric bypass that is so miserable that these people go kill themselves? Well, this has stirred quite a bit of interest and people looking into it. And we also had done quality of life studies and found that people who seek surgery had a much lower quality of life to begin with. They had higher self-harm scores. And one issue that was brought up by some of the mental health workers associated with our organizations have said, are your patients stopping their antidepressants in the postoperative period? Because there's some evidence that our patients do stop them on their own. And as many of you who treat and prescribe these drugs know, that if you stop them suddenly, there can be an increased incidence of suicide. So we strongly recommend our patients, and if you're treating these patients, we strongly recommend that they not stop their antidepressants in the postoperative period, and we keep looking at it. Now, this was not statistically significant, but it raised some questions, so we need to keep asking them. Weight loss was excellent. Most of the weight loss occurred in the first 2 years, and between 2 and 6 years, there was some weight gain in most patients, and then it pretty flattened out. If people got out to 6 years without regaining weight, they were doing pretty well at that point. Here's our scatter graph showing, again, there's a wide variety of response to these operations, but the white line, of course, is the mean, but still very good results. This is group number one, and the black diamonds are those patients who crossed over and had surgery. Again, we maintained them in that group as intent to treat or intent not to treat. But again, the dashed line showed that it did change the old group. But again, the white line was if we looked at those who had not had surgery. So not a big – people, again, didn't gain a whole lot of weight overall as a group during this period, but they didn't lose weight. Group number two, again, very similar. The black diamonds were the surgical group, showing that as a group they tended to do better, but when you put them in statistically, they didn't change things. What was the weight loss? Well, at 12 years, 90% of our patients, or 93%, were still able to keep at least 10% of their weight off. And we were looking at total weight, 10% of their total weight off. 70% were able to keep 20% of their total weight off. That's pretty substantial. And 40% were able to keep 30% of their total weight off. So it is a durable operation. Most people were able to keep significant weight off at 12 years. We only had 1% of patients who got back to their baseline at 1 year. So the operations were durable. The real fun part of this study was the diabetes and hypertension result. Now, we've known for many years that type 2 diabetes is our gastric bypass patients, about 85% of our type 2 diabetics go into remission, most within days after surgery. Two-thirds do not go home on their medications. But at 2 years, it dropped to 74%, 6 years, 62%, and 12 years, 51%. Now, what data didn't come out as clearly in the paper as I would have liked to see, and you're going to see more papers coming out about this study, is that the 49% of patients who either didn't come off medications initially or went back on medications, nearly 100% of those were better controlled on less medications at 12 years. So there is a durable response in that regard. One of the when we compared the two groups, again, substantial difference. And I should point out, in diabetes, 10% of the group number one went into remission, 2%, 5% of group number two. The majority of these patients were patients who had gone on to have surgery. So that clouded our data a little bit, but it was still highly statistically significant. The same thing was seen with hypertension. Now, what about incidence? This was very interesting to us because we looked at patients who did not have diabetes and asked the question, what was the, or high blood pressure, and what was the likelihood of them developing it? And again, we had 3% of our surgical group go on to develop type 2 diabetes, but 26% of group 1 and 2 did, and high blood pressure 16%, 41%, and 47%. So the surgery appears to be protective. It helps prevent people from developing those things. And that was very exciting and has not been shown in previous studies. So in conclusion, our long-term durability of weight loss after Roux-en-Y gastric bypass with minimal increase, particularly between 6 and 12 years. So it is a durable operation. Very minimal increased incidence of type 2 diabetes in these patients. And remission was still 51% at 12 years. We saw a marked improvement in systolic hypertension and lipid levels. I did not present that data today, but it's in the paper and will be coming out in subsequent papers in more clear form. And again, I want to thank my partners for giving me the day off to be with you. It's a real pleasure, and I enjoy coming to this meeting. A special thanks to, this is the real bariatric study group. We provided the patients and they did all the hard work, but these are dedicated researchers. Unfortunately, now that we were hoping to continue the funding, and the NIH did not. They promised, and at the last minute didn't give us the funds. So we're kind of scattered to the wind, but very dedicated people that made this possible. A special tribute to my partner, Sherm Smith, who died suddenly a couple of years ago of complications of esophageal cancer. He contributed significantly and provided many of these patients. I want to thank the NIH for giving us the funding to do this study. And again, it's a real pleasure to be with you today. And I hope that I left a few minutes for some questions.
You talked mostly about the Roux-en-Y, but it seems to me the sleeve gastrectomy has become much more popular and less invasive. Could you just touch on that briefly?
Well, first of all, you're going to hear my opinion. There is a lot of data, and I go back to my slide on the Emperor's New Clothes. I like the sleeve, but it is, the reason it is so popular is marketing, okay? And that's a problem in bariatric surgery. It's simpler to do in many respects, although there's some really interesting nuances, and if you violate some certain rules, it can turn into a disaster very quickly, and a bigger disaster than you see with gastric bypass. It is a good operation. It is not as powerful as a gastric bypass and not as powerful as a duodenal switch, but it's become wildly popular because it's marketed as simpler, safer, less invasive. Well, you're removing about 85% of the stomach, so it's pretty invasive. If you look at the surgical risk of gastric bypass, sleeve, and duodenal switch, it's actually fairly similar. When you look at long-term, maybe the sleeve does have some benefits long-term, but I'm still kind of worried about a few things. And we do the sleeve. We're doing a lot of sleeves, but we don't emphasize it in our practice. One of the problems is heartburn and reflux. And there was two studies last summer that have me very concerned in that they did endoscopies preoperatively and at 1 in 3 years after sleeve gastrectomy. And in both those studies, they had about 17% of patients who developed Barrett's esophagus. If that data holds, that's going to be a big game changer for sleeve gastrectomy. A gastric bypass is superior operation for people that have severe intractable heartburn to begin with. Some of the problems we have in bariatric surgery is, first of all, if you have patients with severe intractable heartburn that you're considering sending for a Nissen fundoplication because they're not doing well in medical therapy, they don't do well if they have a BMI over 30. But insurance is often, they do much, much better with a gastric bypass. But again, many a times the insurance doesn't do it. But yeah, there is there was a whole edition of the Journal of American Medical Association a few months ago dedicated to comparing gastric bypass and sleeve, and their conclusion were that they were equivalent. But if you look careful at that data, they really weren't. The short-term weight loss data was fairly equivalent. The long-term weight loss data was not. And the diabetes data was clearly not. But it is a good operation, and I think it isn't, you know, just like medical therapy is not one size fits all, I'm not sure that the one surgical procedure fits everybody. So I hope that answered your question.
One of my patients recently attempted suicide after a duodenal switch, and during her inpatient psych stay, they thought her Lexapro wasn't being absorbed, so they switched her to liquid. Is that something you're seeing done? She did well once she was switched from pills to liquid, but I had never seen that done.
So we need to do some better studies on absorption. One of the myths of duodenal switch is a very aggressive procedure that does, in some patients, create malabsorption. Gastric bypass, despite what you hear, there is no evidence that there's any significant malabsorption with gastric bypass. And it makes sense. You're bypassing a very small part of the bowel. Bowel has tremendous absorptive capacity, and yet, I mean, I hear professors of surgery stand up and talk about, we all know about the malabsorptive nature of gastric bypass, and yet there's no study that shows it. There was a very poor study published a few years ago about with gastric bypass showing that there was poor absorption of antidepressants. Now, why did I say it was a poor study? It hit the news media. Everybody was talking about it. So I looked up the studies specifically. Now, if anybody knows anything about pharmacology, and that was not my best subject in medical school, but when you're studying drugs, you've got to measure the time that they were given the drug and measure the blood levels at different times after to determine what the absorption and metabolism of that drug is. In that particular study, they drew levels pre-op. The other thing, you need to be sure patients are actually taking the drug. So in that particular study, preoperatively, they drew random levels, but they did document patients were taking the drugs. Postoperatively, they drew random levels and did not document whether patients were actually taking the drug or not. But it can be a problem, and it needs to be looked at. But most of our studies are indicating that patients absorb medications pretty normally. The duodenal switch in some patients, we have probably a half to a third of our patients show no evidence of malabsorption at all. But that means about half to two-thirds may have some mild and may need to have a watch, may have to need their medication dosing changed. Yes.
I sometimes am confused as far as lab work and vitamin supplementation after bypass. So I never quite know whether you guys do the blood work and give the recommendations on what vitamin supplements to take versus if you leave that up to the primary care doctor and kind of what the schedule is. Can you just kind of address that?
Yeah, so we really emphasize and we do direct the nutritional supplements. We're not big on protein shakes or anything like that. Protein shakes were designed to help people gain weight, not lose weight. And most of our patients are able to absorb and consume plenty, you know, adequate protein. Our vitamin regimen is we try to keep it very simple because if you keep it simple, compliance goes up. So we recommend a multivitamin. This is with all of our patients. Recommend a multivitamin every day. Our dietitians say two. Again, it depends on the multivitamin. If you're taking a children's chewable, maybe you need to take two. But at least one to two multivitamins a day. We recommend sublingual vitamin B12, and we recommend that they take a calcium citrate with vitamin D, you know, preferably three times a day, somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 milligrams a day. For menstruating women, we do recommend they be on an iron supplement, but we don't recommend that for others. Now, as far as our follow-up lab that we do routine preoperative lab to check, and then I'm going to be coming out with a paper here in the next year. Actually, I had a graduate student do all the work, and I thought she was going to publish the paper, and she's not, so I'm going to do it. Comparing our preoperative levels and our one-year levels, showing that patients actually do better. They're doing better nutritionally at 1 year than they were preoperatively. But we do levels, and we check, for most of our patients, we check, you know, a CMP, CBC, B12 folate, and thiamine level, and vitamin D level. For the duodenal switch patients, because there can be in some patients some fat malabsorption, we do check vitamin A, and we do a ProTime as a poor man's vitamin K. Vitamin K levels are rather expensive. And again, we encourage primary care, and some insurances require our patients to go through their primary care, and so we encourage you to do that. And if you do draw labs on any of the patients, please send us copies of that. We love it. We keep track of it. We track data. And we love to see that. But again, we want to partner with the primary care and caring with these patients. And that's the same thing, too. If you've got patients in your practice that have had one of these procedures and having problems, get them back to see us. If it is related to their surgery, we usually have a solution and often a simple solution. So get them back to see us. And don't hesitate to pick up the phone and call us. We want to partner with you. We don't want to dump our patients on you. We want to partner with you. Yes. Thank you.
Appreciate it.